Thank you so much, and good morning, ladies and gentlemen. It occurred to me that I should try and fit what I know into the mission of this organization. And so I'll try something new, because this is not what I usually do. And I hope you'll bear with me. And it will be at a certain level of abstraction, and I invite you in the Q&A to become far more specific. But I am a historian of the Muslim world, and in addition to the day-to-day issues that come up, I try and look at it as a whole, and that's what I'll try and do now. To start with, the Islamic religion, which, as you know, stretches from majority Muslim countries, stretch from Senegal to Indonesia, is not simply a Middle Eastern phenomenon, and now can be found in substantial numbers in Europe, North America, Latin America, indeed Oceania. The Islamic religion is also civilization. One scholar gave it the name the Islamicate civilization on the model of Italianate. Not exactly necessarily Italian, but having to do somehow with Italy. And I think it's a useful concept, the Islamicate civilization, so that one will find that non-Muslims who live in majority Muslim countries, share certain attributes. That, for example, art can be called Islamicate. You can usually tell what's in Muslim art, although it's not exactly Islamic. It's not connected to religion. And I spent the first part of my career trying to understand the nature of this connection between Islam and other aspects of life. And in particular, I took up a topic that's a little bit exotic. And my dissertation and first book were titled Islam and Slave Soldiers and Islam. I looked at a form of military organization which is unique to the Muslim world and asked, how can this unique form of military organization be connected to the religion of Islam? And the military organization is the use of slaves and soldiers. Now, to be sure, slaves are used as soldiers in emergency capacities in various places at various times. But the Muslim use of slave soldiers between roughly the years 800 and 1800 was not occasional, was not emergency. It was a centralized, very significant institution called the Mamluk Institution, Janissary Institution. It could be found over centuries in different continents. And I asked, and it is not found elsewhere. What possible connection could there be? Make a long story short, my thesis was that Islam demands of Muslims are so hard and so onerous to fulfill that for various reasons, the Muslim populations withdrew from political life, and the rulers needed to reach out to non-Muslims, and the best way to do that was through this exotic form of slavery. But that was merely a step towards the larger question of how does Islam influence politics? And I would argue that in the broad sweep of history, the Islamic religion got off to a very fast and successful start. The Prophet himself fled Mecca in 622, and by the time of his death, he was ruler of Arabia. And within 100 years, his followers had gone from Spain to India. And more than just military, the Muslim faith was successful in culture, the arts, economically. Created the great empires of the age. So if you look around the world, say precisely a millennium ago on August 20th, 1010, you would have concluded that Islam was the most successful civilization, rather than Chinese or European or Indian. And then, starting perhaps about 1200, especially with the Mongol invasions, the civilization of Islam declined, stagnated, and so forth, for a long time. And the striking thing was that Muslims were generally unaware of this stagnation, but became vividly aware of it about the year 1800, A favorite date is 1798, when Napoleon landed unexpectedly. No one knew he was coming in Egypt, and wiped out the Ottoman and Mamluk armies. And not only that, but brought with them a cadre of scientists who started studying the flora and the fauna that led eventually to the cracking of the code of the Egyptian hieroglyphics. It was a scientific expedition as well as a military one. And the imbalance between the Muslims and the French, the Egyptians and the French, was stark. And it shocked Muslims in Egypt and elsewhere into realizing that in that long period of stagnation, Europe had surged ahead. What followed was a trauma, because in earlier centuries there had been this association between being a Muslim and being blessed by God in a mundane way as well as a spiritual way. And so the break that followed, the sense of forlorn ineptitude that God had betrayed the Muslims, not betrayed the Muslims, but had forsaken the Muslims, the Muslims were in bad shape, led to a profound reassessment of what does it mean to be a Muslim that began roughly two centuries ago, challenged by Europe and then more broadly by the West. And this is, I believe, the challenge that Muslims face today. How is it that the people who should be on top, militarily, economically, politically, culturally, scientifically, technologically, how come, by any index, any broad review of indices, shows at the bottom, in terms of literacy, longevity, Nobel Prizes per capita, Olympic medals per capita, whatever index you choose, you'll find Muslim states are at the bottom, Muslim peoples are not doing well, some of the worst states in the world, like Somalia, worst failed states, Somalia, Afghanistan, Lebanon, Iraq, Afghanistan, are Muslim. And this is a great strain, a great challenge. What went wrong and how to fix it? Bernard Lewis wrote a book by that title, What Went Wrong? How do you explain all this? Now, in the course of the past 200 years, there have been three major explanations. The first one was what one might call the liberal Western explanation. Namely, emulating the French and the British. It's they who descended upon Muslim lands in particular, built empires. They were there as models. They were extremely successful. And one found Muslims, by and large, emulated the West. The great symbolic figure of this would be Kemal Ataturk, the ruler of Turkey between 1923 and 1938, who removed Islam from public life, replaced Arabic words with French words, with brought in the Belgian and Swiss codes, and as much as he could, as fast as he could, made Turkey like a Western country. But it didn't work overall. In the 1920s, 30s, there was a sense that this liberal effort had failed. So what was necessary was another attempt, using another approach. And the approach that appeared at that time to be most impressive was the illiberal Western approach. 1920s were the heyday of totalitarian societies, Mussolini and Lenin in particular. This looked like the way of the future. And these were very influential models, in particular, on the budding Islamist movement in India and in Egypt. And so for the next 50, 60 years, the fascist and communist models prevailed in large swaths of intellectual and political life. Didn't do too well either. Didn't solve the problem. And so, with the sense of failure of these two movements, fascist and communist, came a third solution, namely the Islamist. The goal is not to emulate one or other form of Western ideology or power. The idea is to go back into Islamic experience and to draw on the wisdom and the achievements of Muslims in the past, and to rehabilitate the Muslim world by learning from Islamic experience. Now, of course, you can't go back. You may emulate the 7th century Islam, but you can't repeat it. And the Islamist movements of the last decades have really created new ideology, not recreated something old. But the goal is to do something that is old, that is powerful, that draws on Islamic successes of past centuries. I am convinced this will be a failure too. So far, number one experiment is the Islamic Republic of Iran, which is by any standard a failure. If only because a great majority of the Iranian subjects of this regime are rejecting it. And what we're witnessing now is the throes of this extremist movement trying to grapple with reality. Now, in contrast to fascist and communist movements, where they stultified, fascists because they didn't last very long, and the communists, you know, never could change. Well, China is in some sense a change, but it's not communist. Any discernment, it's got a communist party, but it's not Marxist-Leninist. It's not socialist. In contrast to them, the Islamists have succeeded in evolving. This is the great experiment. It's clear that the bin Laden Khomeini style of Islamism has no future. How are you going to run countries? How would bin Laden be as ruler of a country? It would be like the Taliban. It's not workable. And even a less extreme version, such as in Iran, is not workable over the long term. But what we're seeing is that the Islamists are evolving into something that is more sustainable. And Turkey is the model here. The Turkish Islamists run in elections. They don't use violence. They have good economic stewardship, good governance more broadly. And while there are many problems in Turkey, they have shown that there is an alternative. And so we now enter an era where the Islamists are in part using violence on the bin Laden Khomeini model, but also in part going through the system, working in the political system. Many Islamist groups are making a name for themselves by engaging in social services. One of the tensions now in Pakistan is that it's the Islamists, as in the case of the earthquakes some months ago, now with the floods, the Islamists are coming in first with the most aid. Where's the government? And they win goodwill and respect for their work. So the evolution, the larger story is, how do Muslims answer the question, what went wrong? And are they approaching a functional answer? I think not. I think we're in a very dark period. I don't see any improvement soon. But I do see the potential for improvement. Anything that can get worse can get better. And I do think that there will be a working out of this Islamist impulse. And at some point, Muslims will begin to discard it and to look elsewhere. I don't know what they're going to look for. Will it be a return to the 19th century and Western liberalism? Will it be following the Chinese? Who knows? I have no idea. But I think we're at the very dark period of little creativity, much instability, much violence. I think there's a potential for much more. Chemical, biological, nuclear weapons are within grasp, could be used. Could lead to far greater instability, could lead to an anger on the outside. Until now, the majority of victims have been Muslims. like in Algeria and Darfur. 9/11 is the great event in which non-Muslims were killed, but that was 3,000 people. Other events like Bali and Madrid were 200 people. These are not large numbers by, say, the standards of World War II or I. And so far the West has shrugged it off, not seen this as a really significant threat. That could change. There could be a far stronger reaction. We are, I think, at a point of flux. And I think it's very hard to predict where this is going, but I think it's safe to predict that many more years of real problems of anarchy, as in the countries I named before, starting with Somalia, which is 20 years of anarchy, of despotism, of extremism, of violence, brutality, misogyny. And one of the implications of that is that Muslims want to leave their homelands. And where do they go? They don't go to other Muslim countries, though there are exceptions. Afghans go to Iran in huge numbers. I think Iran has the largest number of refugees in the world. But by and large, they don't want to go to Iran or Turkey or Egypt. There are Sudanese who are going to Egypt. It's not their favorite destination. It is the West. And as you know, with Lebanese, Somali, Afghan, Iraqi, and other refugees, distance is not much of a deterrent. There's the push of problems, despotism, anarchy, and violence, and even more smaller things like female genital mutilation, honor, the potential for honor killings, you find people leaving. And then there's the pull that we have an attractive setup, economically well off, freedoms, security. So I think the press of immigrants, whether they be refugees or economic migrants, is going to continue to grow. And the challenge of mixing Islam and the West is going to continue. It's already a foremost topic in much of Europe. Not quite so much here or in the United States, but in Europe, it's the question of the hour. In particular, as European demographic rates collapse, Europeans are having 2/3 of the children they need to have to sustain their numbers, and there's an expectation that immigrants will take up the burden. As the Christian religion in Europe collapses, as the sense of cultural confidence in Europe collapses, and you have this Muslim immigration full of children, religion, and cultural confidence. One is seeing really great challenges of a sort that I don't think have ever been seen in history. And I would expect that Europe will go in one of two rather unpleasant directions. I don't know which. One is that the trends of the last 50 years will continue. There'll be more Muslims, more Islamic law, more tensions, more accession accommodation by the indigenous population, until one has effectively an Islamic society. And the other is that Europeans at certain points say, no, we don't like this, we're going to stop it, we're going to use whatever means are necessary to stop it, we're going to throw people out, we're going to kill them, who knows what. Neither are very attractive. So the Muslim world, to sum up, is burdened by the sense of glory in the past, success and power. It feels acutely the problems, the trauma, as I call it, of the modern age, is looking for solutions. And at this moment, Islamism is the favorite solution. I suspect it's transient. I have no idea what's going to follow. But this is a population of over 1 billion people who are, in general, in stress. who are in turmoil, and to quote Samuel Huntington, the bloody borders of Islam, who are in conflict with neighbors, with other Muslim neighbors, the Iraq-Iran war. Now there's, perhaps you don't know, a civil war in the Yemen, and also with non-Muslim members, non-Muslims. It's a zone full of trouble, and I think it's going to get worse before it gets better. So on that optimistic note, I'll conclude. It's a little.
Daniel, you see the AKP too. You seem to intimate that that's the model. I mean, they're becoming more and more anti-democratic. They're trying to take over the army that have sort of made big inroads in the last few weeks. They're appointing the defender of the Kurdish tradition. They're appointing someone. They're coming down pretty hard on, I mean, the free press that Turkey had is less free now after 80 or so years of them. So it would seem that the AK can only go in one direction. It won't go back to where it was. It's going to become more and more authoritarian / totalitarian. Would you agree with that? Which means it's not a model, really. It's going to go more like an Iranian model.
Well, I agree with the facts you presented. I could present more facts along those same lines. Yes, as they have felt stronger, particularly vis-a-vis the military, they have stopped being so tentative and careful, and they've taken these sort of steps. And should they vanquish the military, should they do well in the next election, which occurs within the next year, I can expect more of that, more squeezing, more pressure. I agree with you, but I don't see why you conclude that is not a model. It looks like a pretty good model to me. You take power by being electorally attractive, and then you change the system. It's very different from Khomeini, very different from violence. They did this through legitimate means, and then they take advantage of it. I agree with your facts, but come to a different conclusion. The story isn't over yet. And it may be that it turns out badly for the AKP, but so far it's looking pretty good. And a lot of Muslims are looking to Turkey for the first time in a century for a model.
The less liberal you become, the closer you get to an Iranian position. It's all right. It won't happen suddenly with an Ayatollah landing at the airport in Tehran. It'll just take 30 years rather than an instant landing. That's all I'm saying. Am I off the track there?
Well, no, we're not disagreeing. I'm saying that there are two ways to get to power. One is through violence, and the others through the system.
Transformation.
And I think working through the system is a brilliant evolution away from violence. They were in the past dependent on violence. Khomeini got to power and then wanted revolution, wanted to spread revolution. He didn't think about working with political parties. But Hezbollah, for example, which began as a Khomeini artifact in the early 1980s, has become a political party of great influence, even a member of the government. And that is an evolution that's important. Hamas, which began as a pure terrorist group, now won an election in 2005, and then got rid of its competition and now runs Gaza. These are different. This is a more supple and flexible kind of approach to taking power than was the case before. And I don't think, with only a couple of exceptions, fascists and communists knew how to do that. They weren't electorally attractive. Islamists are electorally attractive. They win elections. And indeed, the whole Bush democracy push aborted because finally people realized, hey, wait a minute, we're bringing the wrong people to power. This isn't the moment for democratizing the Middle East, because we're Islamizing the Middle East when we do that. We're bringing our most determined enemies to power.
To follow on the Turkish thing, what would be the chances of them getting into Europe? And can you try and explain why the British government is now favouring their entry into Europe?
I think the chances of Turkish accession to the European Union are very small.
Exactly.
There's wide popular hostility to it. Now, the EU has learned how to ignore popular opinion, and you just vote again until you get the right result. Very interesting, EU. I think this is going to... Nobody wants it. The Europeans don't want it, and the Turks don't want it. So some elites are trying to push it through. As for Cameron, I don't know, I have the sense that he may be nominally the leader of the government, but in fact, it's the other guy who's running the show. I don't follow British politics that closely.
Dr. Pipes, starting from Gallipoli onwards, there's been a very emotional special relationship between Australia and Turkey, there with a very high regard on both sides. How would you see Australia being able to capitalise on that to influence events in modern Turkey?
See, it's not a question I've thought about before. I don't know. I think this is too big. The goal of the AKP is not to be a bridge between Europe or the West and the Muslim world, the Middle East. It is to be the leader of the Middle East. And the foreign minister is the strategist. Came up with a notion called strategic depth. It's often called neo-Ottomanism. Attempt to reestablish the Ottoman Empire in different guise, but be the leader. I just don't know where Australia would fit into that.
Norway.
I'm afraid
probably Norway.
Yeah, I don't think so. Sorry, I can give you something more.
In relation to the two questions of what went wrong and how to fix it, do you see that there's a difference in the answer to that question from Shia Islamists and Sunni Islamists? Is there, or is it the same? Are they the same answer?
I'd say they're roughly the same. The Islamist disposition is not that different among Sunnis and Shiites. And while some Sunni Islamists look at Shiites as bogus Muslims, others say, no, these are our partners. We have the same goals. And I think the latter are gaining in strength. It's an important divide, but among Islamists, I think it's less... You know, there's not that much difference. The Khomeini's vision and, say, the Muslim Brethren of Egypt's vision... There are plenty of... There are a number... As in communism, you know, you've got Maoism and Stalinism and Titoism and so forth. You have Wahhabism and Deobandism and Muslim Brethrenism and Khomeinism. And they differ in many ways. For example, as you probably know, in Saudi Arabia, women can't drive, can't do this, can't do the other. In Iran, they can. And the Iranian idea is that we've created an Islamic Republic and women are safe. In the Saudi vision, danger lurks in every corner to be protected. There are many, many such differences of style and substance. But in the end, they all aspire to the same thing, which is the application of Islamic law. Now, they have different Islamic laws slightly in Egypt and Saudi Arabia and Iran and India, the different schools, but these are, again, details. And in general, the aspiration to apply the Islamic law is a commonality to all Islamists, and to apply it worldwide, no exception.
How significant do you think this distinction of Turkey is between Israel and Turkey or the border of the boat?
My understanding is that the Turkish government has used anti-Zionism as a vehicle for isolating and discrediting the military. The military is what's on their mind. The military is what stands between them and sovereignty. The military could at any moment push them aside. Did, in fact, as recently as 1997. The military has not done so because it feels weak. 47% is what the AKP won in 2007. The military reads the polls and surveys like anyone else. It doesn't have the confidence to. And Erdogan is all the time undermining the military. Most notoriously, there are now two conspiracy theories, or conspiracy plots, I don't believe they're real, that the AKP has accused the military and others of engaging in, and is arresting former military officers and the like, and is trying to get control over, say, advancement appointments in the military, and trying to change the constitution next month so that the privileged position of the military ends and it comes under civilian control. And anti-Zionism, because of the strong military ties between Israel and Turkey, is another way of denigrating the military. The military is embarrassed by this. This, I think, in large part, I mean, it had other attributes, but I think in large part was to reduce the stature of the military, because the military is connected to Israel.
You know, two things really between your comments that jumped out at me. One was the genomic overlay to this whole discussion, and also particularly the role of technology, right, being all the way back to Napoleon, your description of his scientific element of his inquiry into Egypt. If you look at these issues and the problem posed against the backdrop of the last 30 years, there are unprecedented wealth, particularly in the Western world, as interest rates fell and fell and fell, and asset prices rose, increased the use of leverage, which of course ended in effectively the once in a hundred year big bang, GFC, the whole financial crisis that we've just recently come out of. What impact did those events, and in particular the whole realm of economics, have on the resolution or not of the problem that you're describing here? Can you cast your mind forward into the future and speculate on what any impact those things have?
The Muslim world in general is derivative economically. Malaysia and Turkey would be two exceptions where they're really doing hard work and making things and exporting things. But the great feature of the Muslim world is resources, not too different, I guess, from Western Australia. You don't make things, you send out minerals and so forth. But Western Australia is just part of the West. The Muslim world is... What inventions are to be found there? When was the last time an Egyptian company came up with some... R&D of Egyptian company came up with some breakthrough, some new method? Where's the entrepreneurship? It's just not there. It's derivative. And even, especially with the minerals and the like, it's all foreign companies coming in or teaching local companies how to do it. It's very, very difficult. There's no creativity. Or if there is, the people go to the West. There are plenty of very talented Muslims, but they don't have scope. If you want to do R&D, you go someplace else, whether you're in medicine or mining or whatever it might be. And this discovery recently of $1 trillion worth of minerals in Afghanistan just confirms that trend. That you find things and you pull them out. Again, I don't see the premises for economic creativity. I don't see, the stock markets are pathetic. They exist. Of like that's been the consequence of the changes you pointed to. There are stock markets virtually everywhere. You wouldn't be very impressed by them. So I see the Muslim world as locked into this. It's a little comparable to how the Soviet Union was spying forever on the West and getting its technology and information and insights, but also at the same time was confirming its being in arrears. Because, you know, you've got a few years later what the West had achieved. Exceptions, of course, but that kind of dependence is hard to break and takes a cultural confidence. I've done some work comparing Japan and Turkey. And I chose the two countries because Japan had the Meiji Revolution and Turkey had the Ataturk Revolution. They're somewhat similar. Both were very fast. And both were hard westernizing moments. I mean, there's so many anecdotes from Japan where the emperor insisted that there be ballroom dances as a way of saying, we're westernizing. And Ataturk banned the turban, and even the fez, and insisted on kind of little beret. Things which were not in and of themselves very important, but hard, hard westernizing. What I concluded from this comparison is that the Japanese had an inner confidence that manifests itself in an ease, cultural ease. It's you can learn, you can adapt, and you're still Japanese. And so you can wear, especially women, can wear Japanese clothing for formal occasions, Western clothing on casual occasions, and it doesn't mean anything. It's impossible to imagine a Turk donning traditional outfit without that being a huge cultural, religious statement. There are women now in Istanbul and in the East who wear burqas. Well, that is not a it's not something you do on a part-time basis for going out to a party. It's a major cultural statement. Everything is very serious. The Japanese can play, the Turks can't. The Japanese can have Japanese food one day and French food the next day. It doesn't mean a thing. If you're Egyptian or Turk, you eat a certain kind of food, and that says who you are. There's this fear among Muslims that they'll lose what it means to be a Muslim. They hold on in a way that, say, the Japanese don't. And I think that was crucial, the confidence. It takes confidence to export to the... Oh, my... It's very kind of developed. I can't touch this.
That's the wrong button.
And Daniel, you mentioned earlier the world population of Muslims being well over a billion people. Are you suggesting that all Muslims are Islamists and have these hegemonic ambitions vis-à-vis the West?
No, I'm not suggesting that. I estimate that somewhere between 10 and 15% of Muslims, roughly an eighth of Muslims, seek the application, total application of Islamic law. But they are devoted cadres, in large part, who have an ambitious ideology, and they have an impact much greater. As with fascists and communists, you don't have to have a majority. You can have a hard, dedicated, determined minority, and they can do a lot.
You mentioned the cultural confidence of Europe. Speak up. Sorry. Yeah. Okay. You mentioned the cultural confidence of Europe and how that, and then you also mentioned Samuel Huntington's work. Do you see the civilizations, especially the Islamic civilization, being as geographically identical as, say, Huntington's work has been able to put it through in the future, as you mentioned, the two choices for Europe? Being able to keep its identity or coming into conflict with that. Do you see it intermixing and causing issues there, or is it always going to remain quite geographically based?
Geographically based, or?
Or is it going to be more of a global identity than as a civilization, just as we have migration?
Well, there used to be a clear divide between Muslim countries and the West. There were no significant, in 1955, there were no significant Muslim populations in the West, with the exception of some indigenous populations in places like Albania and Yugoslavia, Russia, but certainly not in Western Europe, not here, not in in the Americas, none to speak of. The United States in 1965 had about 150,000 Muslims, population of 150 million. Now it's more like 3 million out of a population of 300 million, so it's 1%. France, it's thought to be about 5%, some estimate as high as 10%. So there is a newfound presence of Muslims in the West, and simultaneously I might note that the Christians of the Muslim world are disappearing. Look at Iraq, for example, where the attacks on Christians, especially since 2003, have led to a massive exit. Bethlehem and Nazareth, which have for centuries been majority Christian countries, Christian towns, are now majority Muslim towns, overwhelmingly Muslim towns, and so forth through all the Muslim world. I think I should say all the Muslim world, through the Middle East. Malaysia presents an interesting case. I don't follow it that closely, but my sense is that things are still in flux, and the role of non-Muslims in Malaysia is still open to question. And one can easily imagine an Islamist movement there trying to push non-Muslims out or convert them. There are small efforts along those lines that could become much more major. It isn't in the dynamic of Islam to try and convert, to bring people to Islam. But what's so striking is that Christian communities, and for that matter Jewish communities that have been there for 1,400 years, are disappearing. There are virtually no Jews left in Egypt, and the Christian population is extremely stressed, especially in the last 20, 30 years, and is leaving. So one sees simultaneously the expansion of Islam in the West and the reduction of what I might call the West in Islam. It's a very dark period. But the good news is, if it can get darker, it can get lighter too. And it won't go on like this forever, but I don't see it changing anytime soon. The vectors are almost all negative. The only positive thing I can say to you is that the Iranian people are alienated from their government. And Iran is a very important country, and it is, in some sense, the leader of the Islamic movement. And so should the Iranian government go back to being non-Islamist, that'll be a major event. That's the piece of good news. Otherwise, ain't much.
The time for another question. Later first, and then someone will go ahead. Thank you. Given, as you say, that surge up in the Muslim world for an answer to the question of what went wrong, and also the relatively small number of committed Islamists anyway, do you see any potential for some sort of reformation movement developing within Islam as a potential solution to what went wrong?
I am hopeful of a reformation movement, yes. I'm hopeful that there will be Muslims who reread the scriptures of Islam in light of modernity and adapt their understanding of it. The opposite of what the Islamists did. The Islamists took the scriptures and read it in this severe and archaic way. And the scriptures are open to interpretation, very open. And I hope that there will be a movement that builds on taking, for example, the ideas of the motivations and goals of someone like Ataturk, but not just sweeping Islam out through fiat, but doing it through a reinterpretation that is authentic and convincing. There's a long way to go on that, but it can happen. And I might add that there is a debate now in the West between those like me who say that Islam is a historical phenomenon that has its ups and downs, and another group that's saying no, Islam is unchanging, is an essential core. Jihad is this, Muhammad is that, the Quran is that, and it's unchanging. and that Islam is an enemy. And this debate is, I think, very important in becoming the debate. The standard bearer of that other position would be, I'd say, Geert Wilders, the Dutch politician. But there are many others. Many of them are ex-Muslims who know from within Wafa Sultan, Ayaan Hirsi Ali, and others. And I think this is the interesting debate that's emerging between those who think Islam can change and those who think it can't.
Yes, in relation to the European experience of Islam in the Balkans, is there anything we can take from that and extrapolate worldwide?
Meaning?
Is there anything that happened in the last 20 years in the Balkans that may lead us to believe that there is something, we're not necessarily going into that dark period?
I wish there were. No, I would unfortunately draw the opposite conclusion. The Balkan Islam in general was a moderate Islam. Along came the Wahhabis, the Saudis, their money, their institutions, and it's changing in the wrong direction, as are other parts of the Muslim world. What one found historically is that the ideas and movements came from the Middle East. The Middle East is the core region, and they go out. And that's the case of late. The Islamist movement is a Middle Eastern movement. You now see it powerful in Nigeria and Bangladesh and Indonesia. It's coming. These are Middle Eastern ideas, and the Balkans. People often say, well, can you take Indonesian ideas and take them to the Middle East? And I say, you know, it's worth a try. Good luck, but I doubt that Saudis are going to listen to Indonesians. Can't see it, but worth a try.
Any more questions?
Just one.
Sorry, let me just say, we've got to bring it to a close. Your next question, and your question, I don't think so.
Last century, I visited Istanbul a couple of times and other parts of Turkey, and it impressed me as a modern European city, certainly in comparison with other Muslim cities like Cairo. So my question is, why do you think the liberal model failed or is failing at the moment in Turkey?
I think the Turkish, the question, who lost Turkey? And noting that it may not be lost, things could still work out. I think the answer is not that the answer is not that the Europeans didn't accept them. The answer is not economic travails and the like. I think the answer is much more technical and not satisfying. Turkish electoral law requires that representation in the parliament be limited to parties that win 10% of the vote. It's very high. It's usually 1 or 2%. Or 5%. But in Turkey, it's 10%. Now, the Turkish parties have pashas who run them for life and don't cooperate with anyone else. And in 2002, the vote, if I remember correctly, was 34% for the AKP, 12% for the CHP, which is the party that Atatürk founded as a leftist party. And then 9%, 8%, 7%, 6%, 5%. All these parties swept down. And the AKP's 34%, which is a nice number, but not a crushing majority, translated in the parliament into a crushing majority. Doubled. 67%. Two-thirds of the seats. And had that electoral law not been like that, or had the moderate left, moderate right party heads managed to work together, I don't think the AKP would have, they could have been blocked. I mean, they're only one-third of the vote. Could have easily kept them out of power. And you wouldn't have seen this transformation. So I ascribe it mostly to a technicality, which, as I say, is not very satisfying. It's the same larger trends here at work. But the moderate left and right parties blew it in the 1990s. They were engaged in corrupt, egotistic practices. Enough. I mean, not that many people, only one-third, but still. It was enough, under the rules. The CHP has been now in parliament, the leader of the opposition, the only opposition until 2007, leader of the opposition since 2007. There are now others in parliament. And it was under a pasha named Deniz Baykal, who was useless. Years went by, nothing happened, no challenges, no intellectual creativity. And he was caught on a tape having sex with someone other than his wife and was forced to resign about 4 months ago, which is really good news. His successor seems to be more lively. So these are the vagaries of Turkish politics that don't have much to do with the larger trends of society.
So you think that rather than society itself in Turkey getting more radically Muslim, it's just the vagaries of the politics?
Well, got them in power. And then, yes, right. And the AKP has Islamized society. And yes, it could swing back. And I think the next elections, which take place within the next year, are critical. Should the AKP win this? AKP win this, it's over. They're there for a long time. Should they lose it, it can be redeemed. So the next elections are the key.
Last question.
Despite your Australian accent, Daniel, you are American. I have to ask a question about America. You're a Washington American, which is better still. What in the hell is happening? I mean, how does the Obama administration, how do the top brass of the Republican Party who are interested in foreign relations, is there any clarity of idea and appreciation of the magnitude of this whole phenomenon that you've been discussing this morning? Or are these guys naive like the Obama thing I put out my hand to Mr. Edmund?
You're asking about the Republicans?
Republicans, Democrats, the State Department, you know, brain power. I mean, how do Americans in your corner of the United States perceive all this?
Well, I mentioned a debate between people of my persuasion who think the problem is radical Islam and those like Wilders who think the problem is Islam. But there's a third position I didn't mention, which I call the establishment position, which is the position of most governments and journalists, academics, that the problem really doesn't have to do with Islam at all. It's a problem of radical extremism, of terrorism, and some politicians go so far as to say it's an anti-Islamic phenomenon. So this is against Islam. And that is the prevailing attitude in the Obama administration. Whatever the topic might be, they bleach Islam out of it. I'll give you one example. The Fort Hood massacre in November of last year. They recall an American major of Palestinian Muslim background took out a gun and killed 14 people. And every sign indicated he was a jihadi. I won't bore you with all the details, but just take it from me. It was very clear. The report that came out recently on what happened didn't mention Islam. It's not there.
It's political correctness.
It was deeper than political correctness.
Pretty big.
It's deep. And I think it runs deeper because if you're going to acknowledge it's Islam, then you have to dress Islam. And institutionally, if you're the U.S. military, that's not easy to do. So you don't.
So they're baffled. Basically.
Well, now there are... What's happening... 9/11 in the United States was a traumatic event. Got a lot of people pulling out Qurans or buying Qurans, reading up... and I would say the level of knowledge about Islam is much greater than it used to be. I mean, I can use words like jihad and sharia and Dar al-Islam. 10 years ago I couldn't use. Everybody knows what they mean now. There's interest, there's knowledge, and one sees evolution in the discussion. Newt Gingrich gave a talk late July. It was astonishing in its specificity, in its discussing Islam, not just terrorism, but Islam, giving examples. New Jersey court case where the judge in a divorce proceeding calls on Quranic quotations and of course, he's a potential presidential candidate talking about this in detail. So things are evolving. There's a more elevated debate, I should say elevated, a more sophisticated debate about Islam, internally and externally, than there used to be. I can tell you that I used to be extremely lonely, extremely lonely. It was two of us, Stephen Emerson and myself, before 9/11, and we would commiserate in our beers about how lonely and how many of them there were and how few of us, and how vulnerable we felt because we're being attacked all the time, vulnerable in a physical sense as well as intellectual. And then with 9/11, all changed, and we're not so much attacked anymore. There are a huge number of people working on the same issues we are. One has a sense that things are... people are getting educated and worried. And I find myself being accused of being politically correct and not because I don't say Islam is the problem. There was a piece on me in the Washington Post just 2 days ago on roughly this topic of how I'm no longer the one who's being attacked. And I got a lot of comments from readers saying, what's wrong with you? Where are you? Why aren't you part of the... Why have you wimped out on us? Okay, well, I don't particularly enjoy it, but I think they're wrong, but I think it does point to a growing involvement in this issue that is overall good. So thank you for your interest, attention.